Hi, I'm Carmen LaBerge. Here's the podcast for Connecting Faith. Enjoy the conversation.
Real conversations about how we live out our faith every day. Welcome to Connecting Faith.
Hello, friends. Welcome to Connecting Faith. I'm your host, Carmen LaBerge. It's great to be with you on this Monday. It's Monday, which means I have some new resources posted for you at reconnectwithcarmen.com. One of the things I do on Monday is I put together what I call the must-read Monday, and it's well, it's kind of a rundown of everything I'd like to talk about if we had several hours together here on the air. So lots of the stories that were just covered on the SRN news segment, how would you like to reconnect those with the everyday conversations that you're having with folks in the community? And how would you like to bring the biblical worldview to bear on each and every one of those issues? Well, that's the kind of thing that I do in the Must Read Monday. So you can go to reconnectwithcarmen.com and access that information. I want to start today with what people are at least talking about in the part of the world that I happen to live in. And people are talking about the Masters. I know that some of you still have snow on the ground where you are, but down here in Azalea country, it's fully spring. And so professional golf is literally in full swing as well. And the Masters concluded yesterday with a pretty exciting finish. And so as people today are talking about the Masters and who won the green jacket, your job as a Christian is to get them talking about the Master. Now, how are you going to do that? Well, the green jacket is nice, but it's not actually the covering that we each ultimately need, is it? I mean, we need to be covered by Christ. We need to know that Jesus has got our back. Now, my favorite Masters moment this year was a generational, it was just this wonderful generational moment that it actually took place during the par three contest, which was at the very beginning of the week. Those of you who know Jack Nicklaus, he now has a grandson that's old enough to be caddying. And so Jack Nicklaus actually turned to his grandson and said, "Hey, you want to take the first shot on this par three, at this particular par three?" And his grandson shot his first hole in one there in Augusta with his granddad, Jack Nicklaus. And he got to celebrate with some other quite iconic golfers there on the tee as he got his first hole in one there at the Masters. So I just think there are some exciting generational things that happen when we're talking about well, things that are legacy events for some families. And so in the part of the world that you live in, your legacy events might be different than the part of the world I live in. But I'd like for you to give some thought to that. Like, what are we doing generation to generation in our family that we're really intentionally passing along? We have talked about what is what's sort of up and coming in America. When we talk about Gen Z, we had a conversation about that last week. We've talked a little bit about millennial Christians, and we're going to have another conversation at the end of this week with millennial evangelical Chris Martin. I'm looking forward to that conversation. But how is it that we are sharing what's really important to us generation to generation? And how are we each and all going to make sure that the things that we rely on for encouragement in Christ today are still available for those a generation from now? And how are we going to make sure that the encouraging words, even that you hear here on Faith Radio, how are you going to make sure that other people have access to the kind of encouragement in Christ that you receive every day? So much of this week, we're going to be in what we call share. And so tomorrow through Thursday here on Connecting Faith, I don't have a guest scheduled. I have you on the agenda. You are the guest for the next 3 days, Tuesday, Wednesday, and Thursday here on Connecting Faith. I'm going to rely on you to call in and talk with me about how you're blessed through the ministry of radio. What have you experienced over the course of your life? Why do you listen? And why do you think it's important that we have these kinds of programs and everything else that you hear on Faith Radio? Why it's important to you that these kinds of programs are available? Why does it matter? What difference does it make? We want to hear those stories from you over the coming days during what we call share. All right, today I want to lift up one story from the headlines, and you've already heard it referred to in the SRN segment just prior to this program, and that is what happened over the weekend in Syria. and how it is that we as a nation are going to respond to that. And I think when we talk about our national response to anything, there are many, many layers to a national response. And so for those of you who are not familiar, innocent civilians, many of them women and children, were targeted by their own government using chemical weapons in the ongoing 7-year civil war in Syria. Clearly, they need our prayers. And so one of the things that I would encourage you to consider doing every day when you hear a news headline or you see something unfolding around you that you really are not in a position to personally intervene and make a difference, but you can personally intervene through prayer. Intercessory prayer is absolutely our first very powerful front line as Christians on every front. And so in a world as small as ours, has become, let's say, through media and technology and social media, the people who survive this civil war in Syria, they are one day going to know that we knew, that we knew what their government was doing. We knew that their government retained chemical weapons even 4 years after our then Secretary of State John Kerry assured us that that Bashar al-Assad had actually parted with all of his chemical weapons. They're going to know that we knew that their government didn't keep the agreement, and they're going to know that we knew that more than 200 occasions over the course of a couple of years, we stood by after Bashar al-Assad crossed what our president then said was a red line, and that was the use of chemical weapons against his own people. So you're going to read today, or you're going to hear today, that President Trump has taken to referring to the Syrian president as Animal Assad. And here's the problem with that, and I want you as a Christian to consider this. Animals don't have moral agency. And I am not willing to let Syria's president Bashar al-Assad off the hook that easily. He is a morally responsible human being, and he should be held morally responsible for his actions. And so as we pray, and as we appeal to our members of Congress, and as we support ministries and relief agencies that are working on the ground in Syria to alleviate the suffering of our brothers and sisters there, then let us also be mindful of our language. People are precious, each of them and all of them, because each and every one of them bears the image of God in the same way that you and I bear the image of God. And yes, each one will one day stand before a holy and just God. And if Bashar al-Assad is not held morally responsible here, he certainly will be held morally responsible there. So as we consider these things, and these are actually subjects that I address in my book, which is Speak the Truth, How to Bring God Back into Every Conversation. You can also access that at reconnectwithcarmen.com. I address this issue of how human beings are different than animals, and how in our culture we so elevate the animal to the status of a human being, and yet we so denigrate the status of the human being as if we are animals. And I think that as Christians, we have to be very clear. We are not animals. And we let people off the moral hook when we suggest that they are not fully human. So Bashar al-Assad bears the full responsibility for his actions, if indeed these actions were his own. But these actions were certainly perpetrated by someone. I think it's important to remember when these kinds of things take place that evil actually comes in two kinds. There's natural evil that's certainly the result of the fall of humanity, but it's now part of the sort of process of fallen creation. All creation now groans with eager longing for man's redemption. Earthquakes, hurricanes, tornadoes, the evil wrought by nature's fury, genetic differences that you and I might have, cancer. These are the kinds of things that are now a part of what we would call natural evil. But there's also moral evil, evil that man perpetrates against his fellow man. Moral evil is what we witness when Cain slays his brother Abel with a rock. And it's what we witnessed this weekend in Syria, in the city of Douma. Who is exactly responsible, and how much, and who is in a position to judge such things? Well, these questions are enormous. And these questions have enormous weight. And sometimes we simply feel too small or insignificant to answer them. But you and I must not withdraw from the moral conversations of our day simply because these conversations seem beyond us. We are the ambassadors of the kingdom of heaven, and it's imperative that we offer God's perspective when all others are talking about national security interests or what business is it of ours, what happens to people halfway around the world. The children who suffocated in their own homes in Douma, Syria, are no less precious to God than the children we tucked into bed last night or the ones for whom we are preparing vacation Bible school at our churches this summer. Can we gain God's perspective on the circumstances of their lives, and can we care about them as God cares? I sure hope so. Caring for people who differ from us and being the church for every child, that is actually the subject of the conversation that I am about to have with Dr. Krasavich. It's not about kids in Syria. It's about kids who live in our communities right here in the United States. So don't go anywhere. This is Connecting Faith. I'm Carmen LaBurge, and we will be right back.
All this earth, could all that is lost ever be found? Could a garden...
Hey friends, I'm Carmen LaBurge. You are listening to Connecting Faith. I am joined for a conversation today by Dr. Stephen Gersovich, and he has served as the founding board president of Key Ministry. He currently serves the ministry as director of strategic initiatives. I think that one of the things that you would like to know about him, because the accolades I could share with you are many, is that he regularly blogs at Church for, and that's the number four, Church for Every Child. He is a medical doctor located in Chagrin Falls, Ohio, and he is the author of the book that we're talking about today, and that is Mental Health and the Church. And I just want to go ahead and tell you, I've got three copies to give to you, but I want to give them, as you listen, I want to give them to people who will engage with their senior minister about actually moving in this direction, in having an inclusion ministry for children, adolescents, and adults who have mental health challenges in your church. So that's who I really want these books to go to today. You can check out what we're talking about via Twitter at Key Ministry, and you can also go to keyministry.org. Dr. Gersovich, welcome to Connecting Faith.
Carmen, thank you so much for that kind introduction, and I'm honored to be on your show.
Well, I just want to start by saying this book really blessed, encouraged, terrified, challenged, and motivated me. As a ministry leader and a concerned member of the body of Christ, as an evangelical Christian, but also as a stepmom to two kids with sensory processing differences, ADHD, and executive functioning weaknesses, I found something noteworthy on nearly every page of this book. So let me start by saying thank you for writing it.
Well, thank you. That's very kind of you. But, you know, as you know, I'm quite familiar with lots of families that have similar challenges to you, you know, and your family. And, you know, more so than anything else, you know, I think that, like, the kinds of kids and families that we serve in a practice like ours, you know, need to be part of a church where they get a chance to, you know, hear the gospel preached on a regular basis, you know, where they get an opportunity to learn and grow and be discipled, you know, alongside other Christ followers, where they get a chance to use their gifts and talents to build the kingdom. And so, you know, one of the things that, you know, I'm, you know, honored to be able to do through our organization Key Ministry is to come alongside churches and help them to be able to welcome and include, you know, families of kids, you know, with all types of disabilities who find themselves excluded from the local church at this time.
So let's talk about that. And folks, Dr. Gersovich is a practicing psychiatrist, and so he encounters people in his day job who don't engage with church. And the reason they don't engage with church is because, frankly, we have a lot of barriers at church to the inclusion of the kind of folks who you interact with every single day in your practice. So tell us about the reality, the prevalence of mental health challenges that families are facing right now in our communities.
Well, first off, Mental health disabilities are by far and away the most common disabilities, not just in the United States, but worldwide. And so we're talking about somewhere north of 50 million people in the United States, you know, meet criteria for at least one mental health disability. 22% of all school-age kids in the United States have at least one mental health diagnosis. And one of the challenges that we see connected with this is that there are certain traits or attributes or qualities associated with, you know, common mental health conditions that make it very challenging for kids and families to be able to enter into the environments in which we do church.
Okay, so when you and I are using this phrase or these phrases, mental health condition, mental health challenges, mental health diagnosis, can you tell us what some of those are? Because I think the range of things that we're talking about surprises people.
Okay, so when we talk about this 22% figure, as a child and adolescent psychiatrist, depending upon whose estimates you look at, 11% of like school-age kids in the United States have gotten at least one prescription for medication for ADHD in their lifetime. 8 to 12% of teenagers meet criteria for at least one anxiety disorder, and fewer than 20% of them ever get any kind of professional help whatsoever, counseling, medicine, anything. You know, we know about the statistics with this being Autism Awareness Month, about 1 in 68 kids in the United States meeting the criteria for autism. We know that there are many kids who are being identified and treated for depression, and that suicide rates are up 70% among teenagers in the last 10 years. And we also know that somewhere north of 1 in 10 adults in the United States are taking ongoing medication for depression and anxiety. And so that, you know, the mental health issues of everyone in the family becomes a challenge. Because if mom and dad aren't going to church, then the kids aren't going to church, and we lose the opportunity to be able to influence an entire generation.
Okay, friends, now I know I've hooked you. So now I'm going to tell you how you can get some of the books that we have available today. The book is entitled Mental Health and the Church, a Ministry Handbook for Including Children and Adults with ADHD, Anxiety, Mood Disorders, and Other Common Mental Health Conditions. The author is Dr. Stephen Grisevich, and you can actually just email us at connectingfaith@myfaithradio.com, or you can always call the studio line 877-93-FAITH, and we'll share these books with you. So, Dr. Grisevich, I'll ask it this way. Why are those families not in church? And I think one reason will not surprise people, and the other reason will.
Okay. Well, there are lots of reasons why I think those families aren't in church. The first one is stigma, in that we know that there's a certain stigma against mental illness in our larger culture. But unfortunately, the stigma is probably even greater in the American church than in the wider culture. There's a study done several years ago by the folks at Lifeway Research and Focus on the Family, where they were looking at this issue, and they found when they were surveying American adults that 55% of folks who don't regularly attend church believe that churches are unwelcoming to folks who have mental illness. You know, so the perception is certainly out there that, you know, that folks who wrestle with some of these issues aren't going to be welcomed and accepted. And, you know, part of what we need to do here is we need to kind of look at our own dirty laundry, and that, you know, unfortunately, in, you know, some of the, like, the theological traditions that are most committed to evangelism and outreach, there have been influential people in the last couple of generations who have, you know, put forward the idea that, you know, mental illness or mental health problems, you know, are a direct consequence of personal sin, that there are too many people who've gone away from church feeling, they were left by, you know, pastors and other church people feeling, well, if I'd only prayed enough, if I had enough faith, this wouldn't be an issue. You know, and, we know that's absolutely not true, and that it may be that in many instances, you know, God gives individuals some of these, these mental health challenges, a way of drawing people closer to him, similar to the story of the blind man who was, referenced by Jesus and his disciples in, John chapter 9. We know that with a lot of these folks that it may be as a result of their mental health disability that through that, the glory of God's going to be revealed. But stigma is a big issue in the church. And, because of the past experiences that some people have had, maybe not being exposed to the best teaching or feeling judged, a lot of folks have been driven away from the church. But one of the most moving comments that I had heard, this is probably close to 20 years ago now, when our church was doing their first Disability Sunday, is we had a couple at the church who were giving their testimony, and they described their experience in suburban Cleveland as young parents with two boys with fairly severe ADHD looking for a church. And the comment that the mom made is that people in the church believe they can tell when a disability ends and bad parenting begins. And so, all too often, in the course of a practice like mine, I hear from families who feel like, when they've tried to do church or in their past experiences of church, that they felt judged by other people when their kids had more challenges like controlling their emotions or behaviors than what would be expected for kids of that age.
All right, friends, I know now you want the book, so you can email me at connectingfaith@myfaithradio.com. You can call the studio line at 877-93-FAITH, or you can just go get the book. It's Mental Health and the Church, a ministry handbook for including children and adults with ADHD, anxiety, mood disorders, and other common mental health conditions. And then I want to be sure when we come back from the break that we give people all of the information about the Inclusion Fusion Live that's coming up. It's coming up in just a couple of weeks. It's at Bay Presbyterian Church in Bay Village, Ohio. And if you want to look at that information while we're going to take a quick break, you can do so at keyministry.org. The first tab on the left is actually for Inclusion Fusion Live. My guest is the author of the book, Dr. Stephen Grisevich. And we will we'll be back here in a minute, and we're going to talk about how your church can actually take the first initial steps in the direction of actually providing for families who are already in your church, becoming the kind of church where families who have children and adolescents and adults with mental health challenges can be fully included and have the opportunity to actually engage in ministry. How do we allow these gifted individuals to move the furniture around when necessary in order that they can be free to do the ministry that God has called them to do? Friends, this is a book that will bless you if you are a family who has an individual or generations of folks who have challenges with mental health conditions and mental illness. And there's all kinds of great information in the book. And we're going to continue our conversation. We got to take a quick break.
We pour out our miseries, God just hears a melody. Beautiful the mess we are.
Hey friends, you're listening to Connecting Faith. I'm Carmen LaBerge, and I am having a conversation today with Dr. Stephen Grisevich. He is a medical doctor primarily located in Chagrin Falls, Ohio. But you can check out his ministry at keyministry.org. And we're talking about a book. We're also talking about an event. And we're talking about you and your congregation taking the first step in the direction of actually being a church that is inclusive of children, adolescents, and adults who have some mental health challenges. So the book is Mental Health and the Church. The event that I am going to ask Dr. Grisevich to talk about right now is called Inclusion Fusion Live. So what is that?
So we are doing a large disability ministry conference at our home church in Cleveland on April 20th and 21st. And it's specifically targeted for pastors, church leaders, but also we have a component of the conference for family members of kids with disabilities. And the idea is, the theme behind the conference, basically is that every church can do something. And so our goal when folks leave the conference is for, for churches and parents to be able to be equipped to take the next next step in connecting with one another, so that so that families impacted by disability can find churches that are prepared to welcome them and include them, in the full range of activities that they present, so that people can grow in faith.
Okay, so you give lots of strategies in the book, and you give tons of information about, where churches can start and some easy first steps. I thought that starting with intercessory prayer was really that was really critical. I really appreciated that. That's sort of the first thing that you encourage churches to do. But then you also really talk a lot about digital and how technology provides ways for churches to engage and serve families with mental health conditions. So give some of those away.
Okay, so basically what we were looking to do in the book is to develop a model that any church could use to be able to, regardless of their denomination, regardless of like their size or style of worship, to be able to welcome families affected by mental illness where they live. And so the little acronym for like the seven inclusion strategies that we share in the book is TEACHER. So that the first one is putting together a mental health inclusion team. The second one is looking specifically at developing, ministry environments that are welcoming for folks who have mental health concerns. We know, for example, while it's associated with autism, that a disproportionate number of folks with anxiety and ADHD also have sensory processing issues. And that oftentimes when our churches aren't set up in such a way, our ministry environments aren't sensory friendly, it drives folks away. So the ministry environment is the second one. The third strategy has to do with focusing on the activities that your church sees as being most critical for spiritual growth. So if that's getting people into small groups, it's especially important that we find ways of getting folks maybe with mental health challenges or folks with anxiety who might be apprehensive about that kind of experience or reluctance to self-disclose into a small group. If it's serving, we need to find ways of being able to get them out into service activities in the local community or doing missions. If it's, coming to a large worship service and hearing your wonderful pastor teach, we have to figure out ways of being able to include them in that. The fourth strategy you touched on is communication. And, part of, I think that one of the most important things churches can do to address the stigma is that they need to talk about mental health issues from the pulpit. And this is something that his credit, Rick Warren, has done a fabulous job with, especially in light of, them losing their son Matthew, Rick and Kay losing their son Matthew to suicide. But part of how you use electronic media is that you can use this as a way of being able to, to empower your congregation to use their social media platforms, to share, good mental health information from, coming from your church, with their friends in the larger community to change some of the perceptions that are out there. Online church and some of the online strategies that we're seeing now are great ways of being able to sort of breach the gap and overcome, the considerable social isolation that a lot of families wrestle with when they're impacted by mental illness. Because having a kid with one of these conditions is very socially isolating. They don't necessarily, they're not involved with all the extracurricular activities out in the community other kids are involved with. Parents can't find childcare. And as a result, they're not going out and getting together with other people, and they're less likely to have then relationships, with folks in your congregation who are going to be able to invite them to church. So our communication tools and our electronic media and our social media and online church are important in being able to breach that gap. H involved providing practical helps for families. One of the most effective strategies that we have seen, for churches blessing families in their communities, providing free respite care to address, these challenges that we were talking about before with child care. Our most popular blog post a couple of years ago was entitled "We Have No Casseroles," and it was based upon a video segment that was done by 60 Minutes talking about the crisis with mental health care in kids. And one of the moms who was interviewed for the segment made a point of saying that, when their teenage daughter got hit by a car and had a broken leg and was in the hospital for surgery, they had casseroles every single night from the people at their church. When 6 months later, she ended up in the psychiatric unit of a hospital after attempting to commit suicide, there were no casseroles. And so that, you know, the types of things that we need, that we do from a church standpoint in terms of care and support, we need to do for families that are affected by mental illness.
Well, and I love
education.
No, that's okay. I loved how you concluded, because he does. You share a lot of stories in this book, and I actually think that's really significant way of communicating all of this is by simply telling our stories from our own families. But when you followed up that story about that family, you then put in this critical measure. And I think for those of us who are sort of, you know, ministry measurement oriented, these are the kinds of things that are the real gifts of this book. You say one measure of success of your mental health initiative will be when families receiving intensive mental health care and support are comfortable informing pastors and church staff of their needs. That's when you know you're over the stigma hurdle, when people in the church will say, hey, I'm not at the general hospital. My kid's in the psychiatric unit, and we need some help. I do think that that's evidence that you're over the hurdle, because I think that for most families, these are issues that we deal with in silence.
Well, I think that's a great point. It's interesting to me that particular point like resonated to you when you were reading the book, that, you know, why is it? And I was asking this question like the other day. I was doing my video. I was like speaking to a family ministry seminary class. And I was asking them the question, like, when was the last time? And these were all people involved in, you know, high school and middle school ministry. Like, when was the last time that you made, like, you know, a hospital visit to a psychiatric unit or a psychiatric hospital or a residential treatment center where folks might be placed? And it was dead silence in the room. And so I think, Carmen, you pointed out, you know, we have a very long way to go, but, you know, it would be really cool if we got to that point where, you know, folks got the same kind of pastoral care in those places that they would get if they were in a general medical hospital.
Yeah, so friends, the book is just filled with really practical help. It's literally a handbook, which I think it's aptly called. So the book is Mental Health and the Church. And the website is keyministry.org. The event is Inclusion Fusion Live, which is going to be April 20th and 21st in Cleveland at Bay Presbyterian Church in Bay Village. I think let's end with the intersection of adoption and foster care ministries, because we could go so many different directions here in this conversation. But I think that there's a lot of churches that have adoption and foster care ministries, and they don't realize that they absolutely need to have a mental health inclusion ministry to complement that. Tell us why.
Well, one of the things that I see a lot in the course of our practice is that some of the most complicated kids that we get asked to see, you know, are kids who are adopted or kids in foster care. And we know that oftentimes, like, these kids, you know, have experienced severe early trauma that certainly predisposes them to a wide variety of mental health conditions, and that kids involved with the foster care system are significantly more likely to be seeing psychiatrists, you know, to be on medication, to be taking multiple types of medicine. And one of the stories that, Carmen, I hear, you know, far too often is having families come in who went down this road of, you know, getting involved with adoption or getting involved with foster care ministry with sort of this idealized view that, you know, for these kids who've been through severe trauma, that all we need to do is give them enough love and that everything's going to work out okay. And oftentimes, I mean, this is very, very challenging. And so that one of the reasons why we've developed a lot of resources specifically around, you know, early trauma, you know, the impact of adoption, the impact of the things that get kids into foster care, is that I think that the growing movement toward adoption and foster care ministry is going to be part of how we're going to bring mental health ministry into the church. I personally think it's immoral for a church to encourage families to go into this type of ministry without being prepared to come alongside them every step of the way. And the kinds of supports that we talk about in the book are the kinds of supports, you know, and the kinds of strategies that churches need to put into place if they're encouraging people, you know, to be involved with ministry with kids who've been very severely traumatized. And so that we see the two issues walking hand in hand, and that the more that adoption ministry grows, the more the need for the kinds of supports that we're describing, you know, not just for kids from adopted families, but for kids from all families who need a church.
All right, friends, the book is Mental Health and the Church, a ministry handbook for including children and adults with ADHD, anxiety, mood disorders, and other common mental health conditions. The author who has graciously been spending time with us here today is Dr. Stephen Gersovich. And you can check out what we're talking about on Twitter at Key Ministry, online at keyministry.org, and at the Inclusion Fusion live event, which you can get information about there at the keyministry.org website. Dr. Gersovich, thank you so much for what you're doing. I mean, obviously, thank you for the book, but thank you for what you're doing to open our eyes and our hearts and our ministries and our churches and the family of faith to these families that so desperately need the gospel and the community of believers and opportunities to serve the Lord our God. So thank you so much for being with us today on Connecting Faith.
Well, thank you, Carmen.
All right, friends, we're going to be right back in just a minute, and we have our regular Monday opportunity to talk with Dr. Lisa Marone. So don't miss it. She's going to tell us how to prevent ourselves from dying sooner than God intends. All right, friends, you're listening to Connecting Faith. I'm your host, Carmen LaBerge. We'll be right back.
I have this hope in the depth of my soul.
Hey, friends, you're listening to Connecting Faith. Welcome back. I'm your host, Carmen LaBerge. I am joined again today by Lisa Marone. She's a physical therapist, a professor, an author, and a speaker. Her expertise ranges from subjects of resolving physical pain and overcoming overeating to protecting against and reversing diabetes. She is an author whose book, Get Healthy for Heaven's Sake, will equip you to feel and look younger by caring for your body. And we love talking with Lisa about what's on her heart and mind. You can check it all out at lisamarone.com. Lisa, welcome back to Connecting Faith.
Carmen, great to be with you today.
All right. So 7 ways to avoid premature death. This caught my eye on your website. Let's just jump in.
Yeah, absolutely. You know, we have in the church kind of adopted, I think, a fatalistic view of our life. Just basically saying, hey, God has decided how long I'll live, so therefore I'll live however I choose. And I believe there is a perfect will of God, and there is a permissive will of God. And God can't make us live well. And so I believe that we get to make the choice each day. Do we want to live a lifespan that looks more like his perfect will for us in terms of our longevity? Or do we want to just throw caution to the wind and live the way that that's easiest and the way that we most enjoy possibly and forfeit possibly decades of time that God has planned for us to do his work here on earth?
So one of the things you may not know is that this Ephesians 3:1-2 passage that you list at the head of this article, and again, friends, it's 7 ways to avoid premature death, and it's at lisamarone.com. Is the passage that was read at the funeral of, oh my goodness, he's the world renowned atheist who just died, the scientist. Why is his name
Stephen Hawking?
Yes. Stephen Hawking? At Stephen Hawking's funeral, okay, first of all, they read a passage of scripture, which I find kind of stunning. But this was the passage that they read, that, right, there's a time for everything. But all of that is under heaven. There's a time for it under heaven, which, anyway, was the interesting point to me from a theological viewpoint. But what you're lifting up here is really important. And language that you avoid that I would use is we have in our culture a tendency, even among Christians, toward hedonism. We live as if you know, it's okay to eat, drink, and be merry. And yes. It is good to eat and to drink and to be merry, but not to eat in certain volumes and certain things, and not to drink certain things at certain volumes, and on and on and on. So tell us, give us a start at least on the 7 ways to avoid premature death.
Yeah, you know, Carmen, the very first thing that I talk to people about is how long do you sleep? There is study after study, Carmen, that show that if we sleep less than 7 hours a night on a regular basis, we're creating for ourselves what's called sleep debt. And what we're doing is we are actually cutting years off of our lives by doing that. So while we think that we're packing more into our days and pushing, you know, the envelope on our sleep, like I don't really need that much sleep and I can get more done, we actually shortchange ourselves in terms of wellness and in terms of years lived. And so there are medical doctors that say that sleep is the most important predictor for how long you'll live, not obesity, but sleep habits. So that's my very first point that I need people to understand. Sleep is not just downtime. It is restoration time, and it's how our bodies restore and can move forward in strength.
All right, and then the second one is avoid or reverse insulin resistance. Okay, now that sounds super fancy, but really what you're saying there is that I need to reduce my intake of refined flour and sugar, right? Maybe I need to keep it to a minimum. Tell us about that.
Yeah, insulin resistance is the precursor to prediabetes, is the precursor to diabetes. It's at an epidemic proportions in our society. And so it's really critical that we look at our lives and say, are we insulin resistant? And my patients say, well, how do I know? I say, well, look down at your belly. If your belly is sitting on your legs, then you are likely insulin resistant. And so we do need to change that. And the way that we change that, Carmen, is we have to start denying our bodies the fuel source of sugar. So refined flour, that means anything white, white pasta, white bread, rice that we've stripped the bran off of, and any kind of sugar product, those things are going to spike our blood sugar. It's going to make our pancreas dump insulin into our bloodstream. And the more insulin that circulates, the less responsive we become to it. And so if we want to change that for ourselves, the best way is to go really cold turkey for about 2 weeks, 2 to 4 weeks, really, of eating those things, and then we can add them back in moderation. But we need to reset our system, our blood control, blood sugar control.
Okay, so if I wanted to do a reset, because I do think that for a lot of folks, that's probably, like we got to go cold turkey because we can't, we're so undisciplined at this point, Lisa, that that we'd have to sort of go cold turkey. So tell us again, how many days do we need to go cold turkey so that we can sort of flush it out?
Yeah, no, Carmen, I would use the word addiction. So we're absolutely addicted to carbs. And if you have an addiction, if you're an alcoholic, you wouldn't just say, well, I shouldn't drink 8 drinks a day, I should just drink 4. You would have to stop. And so that's what we have to do. And so between physicians will say it takes at least 2 weeks of not having blood sugar spikes in our body in order for us to regain control, and 4 weeks is even better. So 2 weeks, and that would mean that you're not eating any carbs, and that means even good carbs, you know, the ones that are whole grain, no carbs except for vegetable carbs, no fruit, no sugar. So you're basically eating protein, you're eating vegetables, and you can eat cheese, eggs, all of those wonderful things. But for 2 weeks, you get really creative how to mix and match those things. But that's how you're going to restore your body's sensitivity to insulin. And if you are exercising, which is one of our points on this list of 7 great things to do for yourself to increase your longevity, if you're exercising, you resensitize the sugar receptors in your muscles. And so those things are the insulin receptors that store sugar in your muscles, I should say. So that those two things are going to be really critical to, like, give yourself that reboot.
All right. And then the third one is exercise regularly. And we talked about that. We've talked about this one before. And we all, I think, know that we need to increase the amount of time and distance that we're moving. But you basically say, 150 minutes each week is going to help us ward off lots of diseases of the body and the mind. And the number four is don't smoke. I like how much you say about that, because basically you say enough said. Don't smoke, enough said.
My brother used to say, when people would ask him if he smoked, he said, only if I'm on fire. And
there
I
you
think
go.
That should be all of our response.
That's really good. But let's hit the last three. And so number five is be safety conscious.
Mm-hmm. This comes out of I've lost a few of my patients, sadly, along the way who are not safety conscious. And so what I'm asking people to do is make sure you do not back out of your driveway unless your seatbelt is on. And if you're going to play some type of risky sport, and that can just be skateboarding, it can be riding your bike around the neighborhood or skiing, put a helmet on your head. I had a 21-year-old young man that I rehabbed from a back problem, and while he was here, we talked about his risky longboarding adventures, and I begged him to wear a helmet, and he said, I just don't like those. And 3 months later, he fell off his board, going down a hill, hit his head, and he was gone. And so we don't need that. That is not God's perfect will for our lives. And so just be safety conscious and wear seatbelts and helmets.
All right, number six is don't load up on free radicals. So I'm not supposed to eat blackened food or foods containing trans fat. I'm not supposed to get sunburned, and I'm not supposed to live under chronic stress. And I'm like, okay, I can avoid some
like
of those.
I like all those things.
Yeah, well, some of those are hard. I did like that you said I could supplement my diet with vitamins E and C to neutralize some of those free radicals. But this one, this last one, I think, is where we should settle in for just a moment, and that is stay connected. Why is that important, and what does that mean?
Oh, staying connected is so critical. It means we need to be able to be involved in relationships. Sometimes as we get older, we tend to withdraw from people and social events. And there are so many studies in the field of dementia that show that years and years and years of our lives can be preserved, mentally preserved, by staying connected with people. There was another beautiful study, Carmen, that showed that if we do something nice for someone, there's positive hormones that are produced in our bodies. And if someone, if we're the recipient of someone doing something nice for us, we produce those hormones also, serotonin and endorphins. But if we just watch that interaction between two people, we're not even involved in it, just seeing that, witnessing that good behavior, our bodies make serotonin, which is a feel-good hormone, and just keeps us mentally sharp. So there's so many things that God has crafted into us in order to stay connected. And, you know, in Hebrews 10:25, he always says, Paul actually there says, that we shouldn't give up meeting together, as some are in the habit of doing. And he was talking about going to church, but there's so much depth to that in terms of our health.
Yeah, I guess I think about even in the beginning of the book of Acts, where it talks about, you know, they regularly gathered together in one another's homes for fellowship and for the breaking of bread. And so maybe one of the things that we can do to encourage those around us to avoid premature death is actually offer the hospitality that we know is it provides such a rich fellowship, not only for God's people, but a means by which God's people can reach out to others. Well, Lisa, you always give us really challenging things to think about. You always bless us. And you're making the mind-body connection for us in ways that I think are really significant. Friends, you can get more at lisamarone.com. Lisa, thanks for being with us again today on Connecting Faith.
Thank you, Karen. Great to speak with you.
All right, friends, that's all we've got time for today on Connecting Faith. I will meet you right back here tomorrow. In the meantime, you can visit us online at myfaithradio.com. Have a great day, and God bless.
Thanks for listening to this conversation from Connecting Faith. These podcasts are available because of listener support. You can make a gift now at myfaithradio.com. And thanks for sharing this audio link with a friend to grow the impact of Connecting Faith. Also, take a moment to subscribe to the podcast today at iTunes or your podcast player and never miss a conversation.